Chapter 6. Unfettered. "You sure you ought to be doing that?" Todd asked, a note of concern in his voice as he peered over his companion's shoulder.
"You gotta listen close, I think. He says what he means, real exact-like," Jodul replied, twisting a thin metal rod in the end of the little lock.
"He gave us the coffer and said there was 30 lions in it. We find a goblet, we get it back. He says,
'I don't care how, just do what you need to do.'"
Jodul mimicked the warlock's voice as best he could.
"We gotta get our gold, see, and he won't care what we did."
"I don't think that meant breaking his coffer," Todd said.
"What's a coffer? Bit of wood and iron. He wants that goblet what got stole from the cupboards where they keep the fancy stuff for them feasts. I'm getting the idea that Warlock Rashan ain't the sort to muck about on small stuff like a broken coffer. Besides, how are we going to spend the 30 lions finding it if it's locked up inside? We ain't even counted it."
"I'm pretty sure gold goblets is small stuff when you're emperor," Todd said, attempting to bring some perspective to the conversation.
"And how you figure he might short us on just 30 lions? Probably got himself a whole cellar full of coffers like that, filled with lions."
"He ain't emperor, he's regent," Jodul said, breaking out in a grin as the lock gave way and the coffer popped open.
The coffer contained 30 gold lions, just as promised.
"Let's go buy us some answers."
The two spent a good portion of the day talking to old acquaintances of the less savory variety. Few men got conscripted into the army if they had a stable trade and enough coin to do all their business in the marketplace. Neither Todd nor Jodul had been much for apprenticeships or day labor. Todd was from Naran Port originally, and had earned much of his coin at dice and reselling lost valuables at a small profit. Jodul was from Cadris and used to run errands for the sort of ruffians that thought they had elevated themselves above the less sophisticated class of scum. That was before a misplaced delivery had run him afoul of his former employers, and he sought refuge in the spear and mail of the Imperial Army as a volunteer. The army never frowned on willing conscripts. Most folk who had known either of the two had been well enough informed to know that they were working for the warlock, so getting anyone to talk candidly ate into their supply of the warlock's lions rapidly. They spoke of old times and common friends, inquired after the health of relatives, and offered condolences when hearing of former comrades who had not survived their last job. When the subject turned to practical matters, suddenly a man who had once known where half the goods in the city were heading would not so much as admit to seeing the sun yesterday.
"The sun? Never seen it. You got the wrong guy."
It was not that Todd and Jodul were armed. Their short swords and daggers would avail them little if anyone really wanted them brought to harm. It was that they were now playing for the side of the law. At length, they found someone who did not know who either of them was, and they were able to at least learn that the goblet had been fenced through someone named Daryl Threefinger. Then the three-fingered thief had sold them the name of his buyer for 5 lions, leaving them 18 after their fruitless efforts chatting with former associates. They were looking for Foxblade.
"Rotten luck. What say we head north? Maybe throw in with McGrin," Todd jested.
Foxblade was head of the Greyhoods, who ran an unfair share of Cadris's less reputable enterprises.
"Nah, anything goes, right?" Jodul asked. "I got an idea."
He beckoned for Todd to follow him. Todd paused for a moment, brow furrowing in thought.
"I got a better one."
The two exchanged suspicious glances, daring the other to divulge his idea first. In the end, neither told his plan, but they went off together, preparing for them nonetheless. They were already near enough to markets that Jodul's side trip was short. He purchased some smoke vials, caltrops, and a small jar of mint jelly.
"All right, you got me," Todd admitted. "I see what you might want the smokies and caltrops for, if in you're thinking this is going to be a snatching run.
I'll be sliced six ways if I know what the jelly's for, though.
Jodul had them duck into a side alley where there were fewer eyes about. He drew his dagger and dipped it in the jelly.
Stuff looks like spider venom, the stuff the Olaks use, if you spread it on thin. My old man showed me once. To most folk, it'd just seem like jelly, but a smart fella like Foxblade'll know about spider venom.
Jodul dipped his finger in the jelly and put it in his mouth.
Tastes loads better, don't cost hardly nothing, and won't rot your finger off if you nick yourself.
Todd glanced down the alley in both directions, gave a little half-smile, and knelt down to pry up a pair of cobblestones from the streets. Keeping his back to the main thoroughfare, he drew his own blade and scratched at the surface of one of the stones, then the other. He drew a small flask from inside his coat and upset it over the two stones, washing them clean of dirt with his fingers. There was a strong smell of alcohol.
"Hey, now, that's a waste of good fire wine,"
Jodul protested.
"Oh, cram it," Todd replied, not looking up from his work. "I'll pinch some more when we get back to the palace. Leastwise, if and we live."
Finding Foxblade was not so difficult. He had folk all over Cadrus working for him, from the dockside to the markets and back again. It was easier bribing one of his underlings to get a meeting than it was to find out about the goblet in the first place. Todd nabbed a street mouse aged no more than 10 winters and told him he would get dragged to the warlock himself if he did not lead the way to the thief's lair. Folk were scared of the warlock, seeing as he had executed 3 members of the inner circle as traitors, and the inner circle was a bunch that none wanted to cross. Considering Todd and Jodul still both wore imperial uniforms, the threat seemed likely enough. The warlock had his hand in far more of the city's affairs than previous rulers had ever seemed to. Reluctantly, the boy led them down to the sewer level of the city. Cadrus's sewers were a thoroughfare in their own right. Despite magical wards preserving the buildings, the city was over 6,000 summers old and had been rebuilt in whole or in part a number of times. The ground beneath the great metropolis was not entirely firm, and over time the city slowly sank. It was hundreds of summers before anyone would notice a change, but the city's forefathers had hundreds to spare. As the city was pushed down into the soil, buildings were filled in, streets walled off and turned into new sewers, and new construction would proceed atop. Thus, when Todd and Jodul walked down what appeared much like the siding of a main road, it most certainly once had been exactly that. Various groups made their homes in the layers underneath Cadrus. The level more immediately below the city's surface was foul, but largely habitable. Its streets were wetted with filth and runoff from storms, but many buildings of the lower levels had been cleared out and repurposed, sharing the underworld with the cellars of more respectable establishments on the top side, and often having passages leading from the world of merchants to the world of thieves. And only the foolish saw the two as such different creatures. Brothels, gambling dens, smugglers, mercenaries, assassins, and simple thieves shared space below, with room enough that territorial disputes were rare. The largest hazard faced by the subterranean citizens of Cadrus were the ward keepers. The sewers and substructure needed maintenance, and the Imperial Circle sent sorcerers about to make sure nothing got too badly out of shape. Folk who lived below got to learn which ward keepers would share an ale or friendly conversation, and which ones were best not to trifle with. By unspoken agreement, the ward keepers were off limits to all manner of harassment. The last time one had been so much as wounded in the sewers, 12 sorcerers and 100 guardsmen had been dispatched to clear a wide swath of the tunnels of all inhabitants. They saw no ward keepers, though, as the young thief led them through the meandering underground city. Folk occasionally passed on one dark errand or another, in both the literal and figurative sense. Torches and lanterns dotted the streets here and there, along with bits of magic for light, but mostly they found their way by vague shadow. Todd was surprised the boy had not tried to bolt and lose himself in the darkness. There would have been little recourse for the two guardsmen if their little guide managed to get more than a pace away and quickly change direction. The stone streets echoed with their footsteps, which would make it nearly impossible to track him by sound. Combined with the darkness, the boy was only a quick twist free of Todd's grip from vanishing on them. After a time, they came to a building that had once been part of the tournament grounds some several hundred years earlier. While the exploits of knights, archers, and gladiators would have taken place in the open air, all about the grounds themselves were seating for spectators, preparation areas for competitors, armories, storerooms, kitchens, stables, and offices for administrators. Foxblade's gray hoods had excavated out most of the old structure for their own use as headquarters. While the thieves' reputation was dark and sinister, the spot they made for themselves as a home was anything but. Once they were let inside, Todd and Joe Duell were met with a comforting amount of light and a strong scent of incense that did a fair job masking the smell of human filth, both from the sewers and from the residents of the Grey Hood's abode. The monolithic guards within the main hall took over escort duties from the rather relieved juvenile street thief. There was a brief mention of a warlock and a message, and two grumbling Grey Hoods took them within Foxblade's sanctum. Mention of the warlock scared folks. No one was quite sure how far he would go to dispatch petty nuisances. The dark parts of the city were quieter than in the days before his coming, taking care to remain out of even his peripheral vision. Todd and Joe Duell knew that the mention of who sent them likely saved them a knife in the gut, and they followed Foxblade's lackeys through the complex, grateful for their uniforms that day. Foxblade's offices had once been the retreat for the royal family when they were in attendance at tournaments. Outdoor competitions were most often held in the warm summer months. Such traditions had changed little since the ancient tournament grounds had been the center of Cadran festivities. Another fact that had changed little over the centuries was that as one grew more powerful and influential, one grew less tolerant of being stranded out in the summer heat. The suite of rooms was lavish, though aged. Hand-painted stonework was chipped and flaking, but still showed splashes of the color and beauty of an older Cadrus. Foxblade himself sat behind a much newer desk of dark polished oak. He was a pudgy man, with chipmunk cheeks and eyes twisted into a permanently annoyed and suspicious expression. He wore a gray square of cloth tied about his head to obscure his, likely receded, hairline. His fat fingers sported rings of gold and silver, with many colors of jewels among the stones they held. He puffed absently at a pipe made from the twisting horn of a ram. It was hard to picture him as the nimble sellsword who had earned the nickname Foxblade.
"Spit it. I don't have all day. What's this about the warlock having a message for me?" Foxblade demanded without preamble.
If not his body, at least his voice seemed both quick and sharp.
"He sent us here, yeah," Joe Duell replied, stalling as his eyes scanned the shelves about the room to see if he could spot the stolen goblet among the myriad gaudy trophies the thieves had stored all around the room.
"You boys gonna try my patience?" Foxblade snarled. "I don't care if you work for the warlock or not. Nobody wastes my time."
"Well, there's two things, you see," Todd said. "First off is a small matter of a pinched goblet from the palace. He's wanting that back. Sentenced with coin, mind you, for your trouble."
Todd was trying very much to sound like the street-savvy urchin he had grown up as. He felt himself almost forcing it, having noticed that hanging about first soldiers and then imperial guardsmen had been elevating his speech a bit.
"You mean to tell me that Rashan Solaran gives a pile of rat scat about a stolen goblet?"
Foxblade sounded incredulous.
"A bit, yeah. Not so's he'd send us down for it, mind you, but while we's here, he made a point of mentioning it. Nah, real reason we's here is he wants to talk to you," Todd bluffed,
hoping that he did not look as nervous as he felt. He could feel his stomach twisting, and the room felt much hotter than when they had arrived just a moment earlier.
"Ha! Warlock wants to see me?" Foxblade asked.
but looked all around the room where his guards and advisors lurked, eavesdropping openly.
Catch this load of vomit. Thinks I'm gonna march myself up to the warlock and talk to him. I'd be on the end of his blade afore.
No, you don't need to go nowheres, Todd interrupted,
reaching into a pocket and taking in hand the cobblestone he had scratched false runes upon. He reached up and...
What are you...
Jodul began, but Todd warned him away with a gesture.
Now, fair's fair and all. You done the last three and more, paid back your debt, Todd said,
hoping that Jodul would take the hint and shut up. Todd finished raising the stone to his forehead and held it there, just between his hairline and the eyebrows.
Greetings, Foxblade, Todd spoke,
using his best imitation of Rashan's voice. He had always thought he did it better than Jodul's impression, which had given him the idea in the first place. He tried hard to keep his expression neutral as he spoke, unlike his more animated, natural demeanor.
What's this now? Foxblade replied,
startled by the sudden introduction of a magically controlled thrall to the conversation, conveying words in the warlock's own voice, it seemed.
I am Rashan Solaran, warlock of the Empire, high sorcerer, and the blood-stained right hand of the Emperor.
Todd hoped he either remembered that bit all correctly, or at least that Foxblade knew it no better than he.
You are Foxblade, once known as Hartan Morull, leader of the Grey Hoods and orchestrator,
Todd knew the warlock liked using big words like that one,
of more than his share of trouble in Cadrus.
Hey, I'm a valuable mover of coin in Cadrin, and we're no worse, and a lot better, about it than the noble houses. If you...
Enough. Todd interrupted, hoping that he was not pushing his luck beyond reason. If he were to get run through for his ruse, it would not be for lack of gusto.
Spare me your perspicacions. It is not the trouble you cause that interests me, but the things that you hear in the perpetration of your dealings. I want to know what happens in Cadrus, and I want you to find out for me.
Wait, you're trying to hire me? Foxblade sounded skeptical.
Jodul had a hand in his pocket, fiddling with the tiny smoke vial in case things went badly. The opportunity to bluff their way through with a jelly-poisoned blade had wandered off the road a few lies back.
You misunderstand. I do not intend to pay you. I am recruiting you into the service of the Cadrin Empire.
Todd wanted to get around the idea of having to explain why they were now paying coin to the Grey Hoods. Besides, it was much the same argument Rashan had made to him when pressing him into service as a guard at the Tower of Contemplation, though his job involved a modest salary.
Let us just say that while in service to the Empire, certain deeds may go overlooked, certain deeds that I may start becoming disconcerted with should you turn down my offer.
Well, what would that involve exactly?
Foxblade was sweating. He clearly had little desire to work for the warlock, but even less desire to be thought to be working against him. He was happy being entirely ignored by the warlock, the Imperial Circle, and anyone with more blades at their command than he did, for that matter.
Plots, alliances, the movement of aggravated amounts of coin, Todd explained,
trying to think what Warlock Rashan might possibly want with a gang of thugs that mostly ran protection shakedowns and petty theft jobs.
If you know these tunnels, you know that there is one that runs beneath the palace kitchens. You will meet me there personally at midnight on each date that ends in 5.
Well, I guess, Foxblade responded meekly.
He was unaccustomed to being confronted. Normally, he would have killed a man who spoke to him thus, or at least ordered someone to do so on his behalf. Yet he seemed unwilling to risk harming the warlock's lackeys.
Oh, and see that these imbeciles are sent back with that goblet. I tend to all details, large and small. Do not become a detail.
Todd finished, and then took the stone from his forehead.
Sorry, he apologized to Jodul. Weren't me saying it. He was calling me one too, so's it's not like I was having a jape at ya.
If you just hand over that goblet, we'll be on our way, fellas, Jodul said, taking over the conversation from a relieved Todd. They left shortly thereafter. Goal achieved.
Excellent work. I am proud of both of you, Roshan complimented them, goblet in hand.
There is a small gathering tomorrow morning just after sunrise. You two shall attend. You have earned it. We will be gathering in the Emperor's suites.
Jodul whistled.
Sounds fancy. We gotta dress up at all?
No, your uniforms will serve, Roshan replied, turning to leave.
Hey, don't you want to know how we got the goblet?
Todd asked after him. I told you when I gave you the task that I did not care how you went about it. If I ask of you how, you might think that in the future you will have to answer such questions as well, which I do not want, the warlock replied, pausing just long enough so that he could finish before leaving earshot of the two guards.
Well, just be expecting a visit from the leader of the Grey Hoods night after next at midnight, beneath the palace kitchens. He works for you now as an informant,
Todd shouted after Roshan, who did not turn, but closed his eyes, lowered his head, and chuckled beneath his breath. Todd did not belong in the Emperor's chambers. Every scrap of fabric, every little plate, every odd little trinket decorating an alcove was worth more coin than he would ever earn in a lifetime. He sat next to Jodul on a divan and tried not to touch anything, even trying to keep from putting his full weight on the seat. Around the room, some of the other guests appeared uneasy as well. A hairy ogre of a man, dressed in a peasant's feast day best, stood trying to avoid leaning against the wall he stood next to, the painted image of the Emperor Tamaran hovering over him disapprovingly. A reedy thin man with a merchant's look to his eyes kept his hands folded in his lap, and his eyes bought and sold each item in the room. A stunning young sorceress, dressed in black, sat perched on the edge of her chair, studiously ignoring the rest of them. The one who seemed most at ease, aside from their host, was the long-haired dandy of a sorcerer, nearly as pretty as his female colleague, who lounged in a high-backed chair with gold arms.
Welcome, all of you, Roshan greeted the assembly. Some of you may have some inkling of why I have called you here, but not all. You should know that you all have one thing in common. You have each passed a test I have set out for you. When I returned to Kadrin, I found that it had been left in shambles. Our army had grown soft and shrunken to the point where Magrin now stands at our borders, awaiting the spring thaw to attack. The Emperor was revealed to be nothing but a puppet of ether, controlled by the inner circle and a few key lackeys. The nobles began quarreling as soon as they found out that there was no clear successor to Emperor Darris, and I spent hours a day listening to them petition for bastards, eighth cousins, and outright frauds to ascend to the throne. I found the highest positions in the land filled by arrogant, comfortable imbeciles and ruthless, conniving traitors. Against these foes I had little, a few chance companions in my kin. I was entirely certain of neither. But this is where you come in, all of you. I have taken your measure and learned you for your strengths and faults. For every one of you, those faults could have cost you your life, had another sort of man come in my stead. You are rule breakers, truth benders, opportunists, and by some measure, traitors yourselves. I not only cast you free of these rules that would threaten your very lives should you come under the power of someone other than myself, I cast you free of all rules entirely. You are now my unfettered. You answer to no law but my orders. The tasks given to you were given with the understanding that I cared not how they were completed. This will be the manner of future assignments as well. If you must steal, cheat, kill, whatever you need to do, do it. Should you get caught by any Kadrin, demand to see me. I have already alerted all the noble houses and the army that all such requests must be honored. If any besides you unfettered use this privilege, I will deal with them individually. One other thing that I ask is this, that nothing be withheld from me. I do not slay underlings for failure,
or for bearing ill news, nor do I vent anger against those who disagree with me. I value loyalty and honesty. Deal with your enemies how you like, but deal truly with me, and you will never have to fear. Does anyone have any questions? Roshan paused, waiting for his carefully rehearsed speech to sink in.
So, you mean you don't care what we do?
Jordul asked slowly. So long as you do what I tell you, all else does not concern me. Allow me to suggest something. I notice that most of you seem uncomfortable in these lavish accommodations. That is ridiculous. There is no living emperor to offend, and I just told you I do not care what you do. Go ahead and break something, Roshan suggested. No one in the room moved. Roshan frowned. Like this, see? The warlock moved to one of the glass-paneled doors that led out to the wintry cold of the balcony. With one finger, he poked a pane hard enough to break it, shattering both the glass and the eerie silence that fell over the room each time he stopped talking. Now one of you. I will not force you, but feel free. The pretty sorceress reached out to a porcelain vase on a small table next to her and gave it a gentle shove. It toppled to the floor and smashed into 1,000 pieces, each piece likely still worth more than a gold lion. She winced at the sound, but Roshan clapped. Well done. Everyone, this is Celia Mistfield, 5th Circle. Her task was to prevent Sir Manfred Halley from keeping his appointment to present his case for imperial succession. He did not appear at his appointed time for an audience, and has yet to petition for a new one. Roshan looked around the room expectantly. The huge man by the painting of Tamaran turned and regarded the dead emperor's likeness, then gently lifted it by the bottom of the frame with one finger, loosing it from the cord by which it hung. The man's finger was not enough to balance the portrait, and it toppled sideways to smash on one corner against the floor. Tamaran was the least favored of the emperors I served, and that likeness of him brought me no fond memories, Roshan proclaimed, beaming. He was clearly enjoying the little acts of vandalism he was inspiring. I present to you Sandbin Colvern, a weaponsmith from Rainsdark. His task was to forge a weapon from a dragon's tooth, a feat he has not only achieved, but duplicated. I shall not go into details now, but it is quite a tale in its own right. Now, who would be next? Jodul leaned forward to reach an exquisite crystal decanter, filled with an amber liquid. He unstoppered it and took a sniff. Nodding in approval, he poured it sloppily across a half dozen small matching crystal goblets until there was none left. Then he took the empty decanter and casually dropped it over his shoulder to smash on the floor as he lifted one of the goblets to his lips. Marvelous! Our brandy connoisseur is Jodul Brecht, one of my personal guards in the Tower of Contemplation. He and Todd Hellet. Roshan paused for a moment and looked at Todd, who took a moment to pick up on his cue. Todd then snatched up the stopper to the decanter and pitched it through yet another pane of the glass-paneled door, prompting Roshan to continue his introduction. He and Todd navigated Cadrus's underbelly to find and retrieve an object stolen from the palace. Not waiting to be prompted, the lounging sorcerer casually tossed a small wire cage containing a beautiful songbird across the room. Catch, he called out to the thin, nervous man who had heretofore avoided contact with anything in the room. Aghast, the man lunged to catch the bird, which was just close enough for him to reach before it crashed to the floor. He caught nothing but air, however, and knocked over a display case of ornamental daggers in the attempt. The birdcage, being nothing but an illusion, disappeared entirely. Wonderful! Full credit to our resident illusionist, Phelan Sarmon, 3rd Circle. Should anyone tell you that the smuggler ship Song of Night ran aground due to rough seas or a drunken helmsman, he is lying. As for his cat's paw and the destruction of that display of daggers, meet Aelon Beth. Aelon also fought at the Battle of Rainsdark as part of the militia. He was a great help in finding a trading company that does business both here and in Magrin. We had need of such men. Other than the items that would be irreplaceable, it would likely cost the Empire thousands of lions to repair the damage we have just done here.
I never liked this sitting room, and since my previous tenure, it has only grown 100 winters uglier in my eyes. Once I leave you, I suggest you acquaint yourselves with one another, and feel free to continue ravaging these tasteless furnishings. Before then, though, there are 2 matters. Firstly, any questions you might have. Rashan waited expectantly. We passed your tests. Did all? Were there others who failed? And if so, what became of them? Aelon asked. Fair questions, both, Rashan replied. In fact, no. Not all whom I tested were successful. Through no action of mine, 2 died, and the rest returned to whatever duties they held before, with no blight in my eyes. Did everyone accept your offer? Celia wondered. Rashan smiled. Nearly all. One suggested I attempt a rather painful anatomical contortion when presented with my offer. That drew chuckles from everyone. And he is alive too? Celia followed up. I brought no harm to anyone I tried to recruit. That is one thing you are simply going to have to see for yourself over time.
I am not wanton or capricious in how I bring violence,
even to those I may dislike. Fail me, and I trust that you will learn from your failure. I do not like failings, but I understand how they can be taken to advantage. Killing those who fail or dissent is utter foolishness, Rashan said. It bothered him how history had taken the detailed nuances of his life's work and painted over them with a thick brush, turning him into a caricature. It would take time, he knew, to alter those perceptions. Any others besides us? Fail inquired, having some inkling as to another who might be kindred to them. It would have been more kind to let another puzzle that one out, Phelan, but since you ask, yes. You are all familiar with Sir Brannis Soloran?
His is the example you are following.
With few allies in the present-day empire, I turned to Sir Brannis to lead the army. I gave him 4 sorcerers and a decrepit garrison to defend against a host of goblins that was undercounted by nearly half. I consider the unexpected presence of the dragon and my intervention to roughly cancel one another when deciding how he handled that assignment. And let me assure you that without Sir Brannis, I would very likely not have survived facing that dragon. I have since given him almost entirely free rein within the Empire, and I am confident that we are the better for it, Rashan explained, gushing about the leader he had handpicked for his armies. He is working on something remarkable, he tells me. I look forward to his surprise. Celia strode down a dimly lit stone corridor in the lower levels of the palace. Ahead of her, Brannis strode purposefully along, trailing his cousin Danilasis in his wake.
He is making this hard on me intentionally, Celia thought. Danil can manage at a half run, and has the energy to keep pace thus. He wants me to give up.
His sword Avalanche bounced along at his hip, but Brannis wore no armor. Traveling about in the safety of the Imperial Palace, and not on any official business as far as she could gather, he had forgone his golden armor. She had always found him dashing and handsome in that armor, but she found she was enjoying seeing his body less obscured by metal as she trailed behind him, eyes drawn to his backside.
So it's really done, Uncle Brannis? Danilasis asked eagerly, looking up at Brannis from close enough to trip him as they walked.
Just 7 summers old, and the son of Brannis's uncle Caladrus, Danil had apparently been involved in a little side project Brannis had been working on in secret. The boy was too smart for his own good, or anyone else's, and stronger in ether than either Celia or Brannis had realized.
Yes, you just need to fill it one last time and it should hold ether on its own after that, Brannis answered,
then continued just loud enough to be heard. If I got it right anyway.
So what is it that you've been sneaking off to do all season?
Celia demanded from a few paces behind them, struggling to keep up with the rapid pace of a long-legged knight and an energetic young lad, while wearing formal robes and heeled slippers.
Since it is too late for anyone to find out now, making wedding gifts, Brannis replied, not turning back to look.
You went to all that trouble to hide from me Just to make gifts for Iridan and Juliana? She asked. Did you think I was going to spoil a surprise or something?
No, not really. You barely know Iridan, and if either you or Juliana ended up floating face down in the sewers, I would suspect the other, Brannis replied, stopping in the hall so that she could hear him clearly. Mostly I wanted a bit of privacy, and to prove I could slip free of your leash any time I wished.
That's not fair, Brannis, Celia shot back, hurt by the implication.
I know that Roshan assigned you to keep me from causing trouble with the wedding. I had that figured as far back as Rainsdark. You are not bad company when we both manage to forget that. But I have an excellent memory in general, Brannis said.
Except when you're drunk, Danilasis piped up, interrupting the grown-up's conversation.
Celia blushed immediately.
Brannis, what have you been telling him? She demanded.
Telling him? Nothing. Danil's the nosiest boy I have ever known, and we were at the family's estate that night, Brannis said.
I cast a quick shield for privacy and everything, Celia protested. Danilasis laughed. That's why I got curious what you were hiding. Brannis's door never has any shields or wards on it. He wouldn't even be able to let himself in.
And he laughed anew at his own joke.
Besides, that shield was so bad. You must have wanted to keep mice out or something, because it wasn't going to stop anything smarter.
I can only imagine what harm we caused his delicate... Danil, you want to tell Celia here where babies come from? Brannis asked solemnly, trying to keep a straight face.
She doesn't know?
Danilasis sounded puzzled. It would seem not.
Well, you see... No! I know, Celia cut him off quickly.
It is from Axterion looking after him so much. The old codger is too old to remember what is appropriate for a 7-summer-old to know about. So he tells him everything, Brannis explained. He's about as innocent as the door guard to a brothel, and it surprises me at times, too. Danil just grinned. He liked knowing things he was not supposed to know. I am sure he will be very popular when he starts at the academy this autumn.
Someone else should be looking after the boy then, I would think, Celia said.
If you are volunteering, just clear it with the warlock first. I do not know that you can act as nanny for both of us. He wore the nerves of 2 esteemed governesses to tatters before Axterion took to watching him, so the old man must know a thing or two about how to raise young boys. I would just leave it alone if I were you. Now, if we are done with this subject, I have a busy day planned, Brannis finished. He started down the hall again without waiting for Celia to respond.
He always has a busy day planned, she thought. He wears himself down to the nub every day, with hardly a moment unspent.
Roshan had commissioned the forge for his own secret project over 100 winters ago, the forging of Heaven's Cry. It was well built and had been easily refurbished for making Brannis's gifts. Sitting on a stool by the bellows was Sanbin Colvern, whom Celia had recently met, and whom she was not aware Brannis knew at all. He had a black-bladed sword across his knees and was polishing it with a cloth.
All finished, Marcel. All but the boy's part, anyway, Sanbin said.
The burly smith did not acknowledge Celia at all, which was more than she could say for herself. She had given an audible gasp upon recognizing him. The 3 visitors gathered around to admire the blade as Sanbin held it up for inspection. It was smooth and razor-edged, with finely carved runes etched into the surface, only visible when the light caught them just so, being black on black. It curved slightly all the way down its length, a stylistic choice reminiscent of the dragon's fang from which it had been made. It even retained the length that it originally had in the mouth of Nahash Tukali, the mighty dragon they had slain at Rainsdark more than a season ago. It would be a great sword to Iridan, too long for even Brannis to wield properly with one hand. Celia leaned in close to examine the runes.
I do not recognize these. I mean, I know the individual runes, but none of the patterns make sense.
The stone folk showed me. I paid them enough in dragon bones and scales to rebuild 5 cities. I insisted as part of the bargain that they show me how to work the stuff ourselves, considering how resilient it all is. Try to imagine forging a sword when the ingots are impervious to fire. Well, Sandbin had that very problem given to him by the warlock, and came to me for help, Brannis explained, smiling with pride. Well, the stone folk use special acids to etch runes into the bone. They create wards to soften the bone to the point where it can be worked with a hammer. After it gets flattened out, they hammer the runes out of it, and it hardens again. Once they get that going, they etch the softening runes on one side, and the runes they want the finished blade to carry on the other. They then fold the piece, sealing the finished runes inside, before the blade is flattened again, and the process is repeated.
Would that not destroy the runes within, as the material is stretched? Celia asked, curious and impressed. She had not expected to come down to a forge in her formal attire, having caught Brannis shortly after leaving the meeting of the newly chartered Unfettered. But she was already finding the trip worth the taking.
They thought of that, of course. Every layer has protections for the runes, so they stay intact as the blade is folded and flattened, Brannis answered.
And Danny Lace's part in all this? Celia asked. More secrecy?
Hardly. He has kept the secret well, I will grant. But I need someone with a strong enough source to empower the runes. Someone not busy about a dozen other tasks. I had tried a few sorcerers I could pry free from Dolvain's oversight, but none could manage. I went to Axterion to ask his advice, and he recommended Danil. I had no idea how strong he was already, Brannis said. He has done a wonderful job. Danny Lasis smiled, looking that peculiar mixture of innocent and smug that only young children can manage.
How hard can it be? Most sorcerers do a stint as ward keepers at some point of their career, unless they are well connected. You could have just asked me, you know, Celia said to Brannis. It seemed silly to her that he would involve a 7-summer boy when more competent help was so close at hand.
Go ahead, try it,
Danny Lasis said, grinning at her.
Oh no, I could not. You have already worked so hard on it. It would not feel right, Celia demurred.
Oh, it's all right. I'll still get to do it, he replied sweetly.
Arrogant little imp. I will show him.
Celia took the blade from Sandben's hands and focused her ether into it. She felt the flow seeping into the blade, but it slowed the further into the runes it went. It was like pulling back a bowstring, easy at first, but growing harder rapidly the further it was drawn. Before long, she gave up, and the ether spat harmlessly back out.
You can try again if you want, Danil smiled, enjoying seeing her fail.
Just finish it, Danil, Brannis interrupted. We have a lot to do today, and it's not getting done while you and Celia play at this.
He must feel like he's watching two children instead of one, Celia realized. Why am I competing with a little boy?
Celia set the blade down on a work table, and Danilasis laid his hands on it. Celia shifted her vision into the ether to watch. When she did so, she noticed that Danilasis had a source stronger than just about anyone she had met. Usually a source was not fully matured until puberty or thereabouts, so either the boy was well ahead of his peers, or he was destined for great power. Iridan, Caladris, Dolvain, Jinzan, the dragon. She had seen stronger sources, but never on one so young. Danilasis furrowed his brow in concentration, seeming serious for the first time she had seen all day. Ether flowed into the blade, slowing as it went, but never coming to a stop. After a few moments, the runes sprang to life, glowing blue-white against the black dragonbone metal.
That was harder than the daggers, Danilasis observed sagely, turning to his elders for approval.
He turned back to the blade before any of them could say anything, though, and picked it up by the handle.
Danil, be careful, Brannis shouted.
Vroom, vroom.
The blade cut through the air effortlessly. Brannis, Celia, and Sandbin took cover.
Uncle Brannis, try to block it with your sword, Danilasis called out.
Brannis kept his head low and did no such thing.
Dan'l, put that down right now before you hurt someone, Brannis ordered. Of all the people in Cadran who would jump to obey an order from the Grand Marshal of the Imperial Army, Danilasis was far down the list in Celia's mind.
I helped make it. I just want to try it before you give it to Uncle Iridan, Danilasis said, slamming the blade clean through the work table he had just been using.
Oops. Dan'l realized he had overstepped caution by a wide margin. It was all sunshine and roses to say you just wanted to try something, but once you smashed a piece of furniture to pieces, you lost a lot of credibility with the I have it under control argument. Danilasis set the sword down on the floor and stepped back from it. Brannis took 3 angry steps across the room and picked up the blade, examining it for damage. It had picked up a bit of grime, but was unharmed. Brannis took a cloth when Sanbin proffered it and began cleaning Iridan's sword.
He has a war to run and a wedding to prepare for, yet here he sits, cleaning a sword, Celia thought.
It was going to be a long day.
Still, it was impressive to see it work.
She could not help noticing the grin on Brannis's face, carefully turned so that Danilasis could not see.
I bet he wishes he had been the one to try it.
Marshal Brannis! Came a shout from across the docks. Marshal Brannis, I need a word with you.
The shouting voice belonged to Dolvain Lurien, to whom Rashan had ceded the day-to-day operation of the Imperial Circle. Brannis had been waiting half the afternoon and well into the evening for Dolvain to arrive, while he oversaw the final preparations. He had not invited the second highest-ranked sorcerer in the Empire, but had arranged for matters to require his attention. Brannis turned from the plans he was studying and looked to the self-made sorcerer of no bloodline at all. Nearby, one of the Imperial Navy's ships swarmed with activity. Carpenters, riggers, shipwrights, and sorcerers bustled about anxiously. It was well past the time that they usually broke off from working and went for their evening meal, but they were so close to completion. None wanted to miss the spectacle that everyone had been picturing since Brannis had recruited them for his plan, so they worked past sundown in the growing cold of night on the waterfront. Brannis hailed the sorcerer as he drew to a more polite distance that did not require shouting, such that the whole Cadrus seaport could hear him.
Fair evening, Sorcerer Dolvain.
Fair evening yourself, Dolvain replied brusquely, a note of annoyance in his tone. What is the meaning of this?
You asked for sorcerers, and I assigned 4 to help you in your mysterious project. I find that you have 11 working for you now.
In practical terms, yes, but technically no. You assigned me 4, and indeed they have been helping me admirably. But you see, those 4 had subordinates, so technically 7 of those 11 are merely working for the other 4, Brannis reasoned. He had suspected that some of the logic might fail to make a pressing case, but he had been using the subordinate sorcerers for days and had gotten plenty of use from them in the meantime.
You cannot cut eggs in half with me to double them, Sir Brannis. I have fielded complaints of wards in need of repair, or ether having gone unanswered for days. You are crippling the ward keepers and have one of my best rune carvers unavailable for lucrative jobs that I cannot just pass off to lesser artisans. This was not meant to be a permanent assignment. Nor had I intended that you press more than the 4 assigned to you into service.
Dolvain spoke quickly, likely having organized the diatribe into a neat little speech on his journey from the tower. He had managed to give Brannis no opening to interject until he was finished.
You do have a point. My apologies. Perhaps I can send my cousin Danilasis to help shore up your numbers. I have found him to be quite adept, Brannis told Dolvain.
Then he turned back to the ship and called up to one of the sorcerers on board.
Krogan, is she ready to test?
Aye, aye, Captain,
the sorcerer responded, making an attempt to sound nautical.
What have you done to that vessel? Dolvain asked. The rigging is a mess. You have cargo netting everywhere, and I do not even see what you have done with most of the sails. What sort of seafaring monstrosity have you got my ward keepers working on?
Why, none at all, Brannis replied simply, and waited.
There was a rumbling sound and a creaking of protesting wood. Slowly, the ship rose. Seawater ran off her sides to make a small, sloppy rain into Cadrus Harbor, until even the keel was free of its aquatic medium. All the workers on board rushed to the sides of the ship, looking down at the docks as they ascended. There were hoots and cheers as even sorcerers past 50 summers found childlike glee in the sensation of flying.
"Take it around the harbor once and set her back down," Brannis ordered Krogan, shouting up at the vessel now well above them, grinning as broadly and proudly as any aboard.
Brannis and Dolvain watched as the vessel made a circuit of the airspace around Cadrus Harbor, using just one small sail and a magically created wind to power them. Another sail was set fore to aft to act as a rudder. Dolvain stared in silence. As the ship settled back down in the water, Brannis leaned close to Dolvain. "This is how I intend to deal with the Magrin cavalry and siege weapons.
I will find as many sorcerers as I can spare and put them at your disposal,"